Welcome to UBS On Air. This is the Sustainable Investing Exchange. The Sustainable Investing Exchange is a podcast series dedicated to sharing industry insights on implementing a sustainable strategy. Each episode will feature a UBS leader in sustainability alongside an industry authority from one of our leading asset management partners. The series will build progressively with each episode going a bit deeper than the previous. For part five, we're calling it Narrowing the Income Inequality Gap. What it is, why it's currently at an all-time high, ways that it can be potentially repaired, and why it impacts all of us. My guests, Eugenia Jackson, head of ESG research at Allianz Global Investors, where she is responsible for directing ESG research, guiding and overseeing Allianz GI's stewardship activities, and my UBS colleague, strategist from the Chief Investment Office, Andrew Little. Thank you both to Eugenia and Andrew for joining me on the podcast today. Great to have you both.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thanks, Anthony.
Great to be here.
Great. So, Eugenia, let's start by explaining to our audience what income inequality means and, importantly, who is impacted by it.
Well, income inequality is an extreme concentration of wealth or income in the hands of a small percentage of a population. It is often described as the gap between the richest and the rest. Income inequality impacts society as a whole. So, for example, high levels of income inequality are often linked to economic and political instability, debt, inflation, which are believed to be damaging the economy in the long term. It is also well established that unequal societies have less social mobility and lower level of education. They have lower level of health, lower life expectancy, higher levels of mental illness or obesity, and higher rates of infant mortality. Inequality increases property crime and violent crime. It also affects how people see those around them and their level of happiness. So people in less equal societies are less likely to trust each other, less likely to engage in social or civic participation, and less likely to say that they're happy.
Right. So clearly, there's to start off this conversation, we can hear all of us from your explanation that it is something that we need to be discussing and even figuring out how to fix. So that being said, Eugenia, it is near an all-time high on the inequality sector. Why is that?
Well, it is true that economic inequality may be at its highest level since the Industrial Revolution. Even though extreme poverty has fallen in recent years, the economic inequality has grown more pervasive. There's a large body of research out there sort of giving the data on the levels of economic inequality. Just taking the OECD data, there is a very high level of inequality in South Africa, followed by Mexico, Chile, Turkey. In the developed markets, the data shows that the U.S. has the highest level of income inequality. And as an example, the top 1% of the U.S. population own more than 38% of the country's total wealth in 2016.
Where is it highest currently?
The highest one is South Africa, from the data that I have seen. But from the developed markets, the U.S. Definitely is at the very high end. But it is also true that the economic inequality is rising worldwide, and I've seen some research suggesting that the richest 1% in the world now own 45% of the world's wealth. Now, you asked why it is, and there are a number of factors, and I can only name a few, but Andrew, please chip in as well. I think one of the most important one is the globalization and the rise of global manufacturing, which enabled goods to be produced in low-cost centers. So on one hand, it's very positive because it increased the affordability of consumer products, including high-tech goods, for example. But on the other hand, it hollowed out the whole industries in developed countries, including such traditional big employers as manufacturing, mining, steel. We also see that the rise of robotics, automation, artificial intelligence can threaten conventional jobs in the future even further. So even things like the demand for highly skilled workforce in certain sectors, for example, technology, engineering, healthcare, may also be contributing to income inequality. Companies who have invest heavily to hire and keep workers with these highly demanded specialized skills also have to seek to reduce costs elsewhere, such implementing workforce cuts or pay cuts or automation, which is also making lives harder for people in lower skilled, less competitive jobs. And another factor I would mention is also financial globalization, because it played a big role in making inequality worse by helping those who have wealth to further increase it. So the rich are getting richer because they're able and willing to invest in riskier assets. For example, those who were able to invest in the financial market since the 1980s have done extremely well. But by contrast, the large number of people who don't invest in risk assets have found themselves increasingly further behind. So, in my view, together, these and other developments have reduced and further threatened to reduce the traditional work opportunities that once supported large segments of the population. And this is the opportunity gap, and particularly for the next generation, is going to be the big issue that the world would need to address.
Andrew, can you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, just on the topic of globalization, you think a lot about the solutions of solving income inequality. And one of those is kind of stopping it at the source by educating the youth and giving them the tools that they need to compete. However, there's this this educational globalization, which is happening where people are educated in their home countries or in other countries and then do not bring those skills back to their own country, only mm-hmm. perpetuating the issue, because then you have some of those countries with higher institutions of education where people may get that education and then just stay where they are instead of going back and addressing the actual gap.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, Andrew, one of the things that we've spoken about many times on this series is the ESG framework as a whole, environmental, social, and governance. Where does income inequality fit in ESG?
Well, oftentimes when we hear ESG, we jump straight to the E for environment, as some of the issues may be easier to conceptualize, and we see them in our news headlines on a daily basis. But the social S and the governance G are equally important, albeit more nuanced. Worker treatment, whether it be employee safety or in this case, wages, income inequality, and quality of life, which is directly related to wages, are a big part of the S. And more importantly, reducing inequalities is one of the United Nations' 17 Sustainable Development Goals, which, for those of you who may not know, are 17 broad issues that must be funded to address the unsustainable growth that we are witnessing in our world today. The SDGs serve as a great framework for looking at issues of sustainability, particularly as an investor. In regards to income inequality, as a sustainable investor, you can look for metrics in the companies you're investing in, like the income gap between executives and workers, or men and women, or just any marginalized group versus the majority. Mm-hmm. And you can actually integrate those factors, those measurements, into your investment process and look for those companies and other investments that perform well on those issues, or at the very least, disclose information around it. You can also use impact investing to address some of the inequality at a more fundamental level against stopping the systemic issues that we're seeing, but at the source. This could be in the private markets, where you know exactly where your capital is going and what it's going to do. So a private equity type of structure or a direct investment type of structure. Totally hypothetical example. You could invest directly in schools for young women in areas where they may not have had access to education otherwise, equipping them with the tools they need to enter the workforce and giving them a voice to force change. Mm-hmm. So income inequality fits great in the ESG sustainable investing framework overall.
Right. Thanks, Andrew. It's important, obviously, for us to talk about that, since there is still a lot of unknown or there are some misconceptions about what ESG is and sustainable investing is in the first place. So, Eugenia, obviously, this is a situation that can impact every single one of us, not just those people who are impoverished. Can you explain why that is and what the broader impact is on society?
Yes, sure. I think you have to distinguish between different countries, and the impact will be different and how it plays out will be different. And for example, in the emerging world, where the most wages are still relatively low, wealth inequality is a bigger issue. Not enough people own their own homes or have sufficient savings, pensions, access to education, healthcare. In developed markets, we're facing a problem where a decreasing number of relatively wealthier individuals have to shoulder more of the tax burden. Plus, we have the situation where the social safety net is growing strained as ever larger proportion of the population are unable to afford basic living expenses, quality medical care, retirement savings, and all of this is exacerbated by the rising inflationary cost of healthcare. But I think more importantly that the worldwide economic inequality is a massively destabilizing force. It creates distrust, it undermines cohesion, it increases the appeal of factional politics. And in the world of this ultimate openness, which is aided by social media, people today are a lot more aware of what they are missing compared to others than were their previous generations. So, I mean, it boosts populist politics. It has social cost because where people perceive that they have fallen behind, it affects their health. It affects the well-being overall. They can be more stressed, they grow less healthy, they make riskier decisions, and then as they try to catch up. So all of us live in the societies, so we can't isolate ourselves. So we are affected by these issues, and they impact all of us in one way or another.
It's interesting. You brought up a really good point about how social media, we've always said that technology makes the world, quote unquote, smaller. But when you make the world smaller, people start to realize what they're missing. And it's really important that that we educate folks on what that means and the broader impact of that. Eugenia, thanks. It was a terrific point. Let me ask you both, though, is this something that can be repaired? I'm not even sure if that's the right word to say, but is it something that can be addressed and fixed?
Yeah, I think it's a really tough question, as some of the issues are systemic and must be addressed over time. And some of those things can also be addressed in the short term. So I think it's best to look at this kind of in a two-pronged way. Mm-hmm. So looking at the now, I think it could be a balance of government intervention and also market signaling from investors. This could mean on the government level, regulations on companies. In December, the UK announced that they're looking to force mandatory corporate reporting around ethnicity-based pay gaps. And then we also saw recently New York increasing Uber and Lyft driver minimum wages in New York City. Or government intervention. This is more of a touchy aspect of this. Could mean setting an income gap standard, or it could also mean income redistribution, higher taxes, transfers, and universal income. Some of those things have become dirty words, but those are only part of the government intervention that would work. And then I'm not promoting any of those ideas, but I do think that this does present a question of whether this is an issue at the corporate or citizen level. Mm-hmm. At the citizen level, investors could choose to invest in only those companies that are addressing the gap, reallocating capital away from companies that don't perform well on those issues or don't disclose them at all. And then in the longer term, again, the two-pronged response, I think if done right, the longer-term prospects of addressing this seem a little better. First, everyone needs to have equal access to an education. Being educated is so important in a competitive job environment, and it's something that really helps to give a voice to marginalized people. By providing equal access to it, perhaps industries dominated by a single or a few demographics will become more diverse, and this change will sweep through management, forcing equality from above. People also must be educated on the fact that a retirement income is no longer a guarantee. Hopefully, stressing the importance of gaining skills and starting a career that can provide a sustainable income for life from now and in the future, this can greatly help to address some of the income inequality issues we see today.
Terrific. Eugenia, anything to add to that on the idea or question of it, how it can be repaired?
Yeah, sure. And I think we need to think about how companies, corporations, and particularly large global corporations can play a significant role in this. We think that corporations can and should be promoting corporate fiscal responsibility. They also should put a lot of effort and resources into boosting development and training for their employees, as well as establishing more fair compensation practices and speeding up their sustainability efforts. I mean, in particular, if you look at the workforce and what companies can do, the modern workforce needs training. They need investment and support. And the management team should really move into a more cooperative approach towards managing and retaining employees. I mean, if you look at successful companies, they tend to pay somewhat more than the less successful ones. They have better people, better remuneration, and better people and better remuneration deliver better productivity. So that's what companies can do, but investors can do an awful lot as well, even by choosing to invest in companies that may not be yet at the forefront of this effort. Investors can promote that and encourage companies to adopt more responsible corporate governance, more sustainable business practices. In particular, we can and we have all the power to pressure management teams and boards to focus more on environmental, social, and governance factors that can help reduce inequality. And I would say that for companies, it's imperative that they pay attention to this and work on this. And just to maybe, if I have a minute to say that when you look at companies and when you look at companies from the ESG analysis perspective, we look at the risks to businesses, and we look at, you know, how the businesses manage this risk. And the income inequality in the society creates a number of very significant risks for companies. These are political risks and instability in countries they operate in. The loss of trust in business is already leading to very significant political and regulatory backlash in some markets. Businesses that are not trusted and respected, their needs will not be a priority for governments, and the negative public sentiment can lead to can drive anti-business policies. We also see that we talk to many companies where they point out that decreasing educational and skill levels in the society are starting to starve businesses of the resources they mm-hmm. need, that they need. And the impact on health and well-being of the employees reduces their productivity, leading to high absenteeism rates, turnover, higher costs. So these are the risks that businesses are facing today already, maybe more pronounced in some countries than in others. But if they don't manage these risks, that's not going to and rely purely on governments and on policymakers, that's not necessarily going to work for them in the short or medium term. So there is a role to play for all actors in the society, including businesses.
Right. And, you know, you both mentioned education on how important it is to start there. And it seems like overall what I'm hearing from both of you is we have to focus on growing, whether it's economic growth, corporate growth, growth in education. How important is that, Eugenia, overall, just overall growth in any particular society?
I think when we talk about growth, we would like to talk about inclusive growth. So not just growth at any cost, but growth that is shared throughout the society in a way that helps to reduce economic inequality. For example, for companies, as Andrew referred to, you know, having responsible tax practices, having a responsible approach to corporate fiscal responsibility is extremely important to support the societies that they rely on and operate in. You know, capital management, how much companies invest in development and innovation, that's an important consideration for investors when we look at businesses. You know, we talked about human capital management and diversity gaps, but simple things like contractor management and responsible practices in supply chain, you know, knowing your supply chains, knowing where the issues are, and not just at the first tier, but second, third tier, beyond that in the supply chain, and dedicating resources to ensure responsible social practices, as well as environmental and others, that can have a very significant impact on the productivity and the performance of the business, but also on the well-being of the different stakeholders who depend on that business globally across the entire supply chain. So the growth in itself is, of course, it is important. We have a growing population, and we need to support that, and we need to sustain it. But it's a growth that should be inclusive and should be considerate of the needs of the different stakeholders that businesses rely on.
You know, historically, one of the biggest supporters of income equality was Henry Ford. He believed that higher pay could result in greater productivity, reduced turnover, and overall higher profits. And he also said it could help the middle class grow. And that was back in 1914. And it was the Model T factory. They were making the cars there. He paid workers $5 a day, which was unheard of because in today's money, it's about $120. Andrew, could paying higher wages actually turn around the economy just like Henry Ford said it could?
I think that it really depends on the company and the region where you're kind of making this change. From a moral standpoint, I think it's definitely a good thing. It definitely increases productivity of workers in the now. But as I said, there are many schools of thought. On the one hand, some economists point to increasing minimum wage as detrimental to corporate profits, and an increase of wage could force those businesses to close or lay off workers who then wouldn't have a job at all. But then on the other hand, the more positive hand, there's a lot of evidence out there that shows increasing minimum wage, as you said, increases worker productivity, which thus increases corporate profits and allows them to hire more workers and so on and so forth, increasing employment,
right,
which is a great signal of economic health. There's a great study by Alan Krueger in the 1990s that looked at fast food restaurants in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and studied them while New Jersey underwent a minimum wage increase. Overall, it was found that employment in New Jersey increased by 13% at the stores with the increased wage, because there were some stores already out there that had higher wages. Some that had lower. And the stores in New Jersey that didn't have to increase their wage saw no change in employment at all. In Pennsylvania, where the wage didn't increase at all, no change of employment, even some negative effects. Mm. So that's a very small example, but I think a good example of how income inequality could be addressed by raising the minimum wage. Although that is not an economic opinion. That is more of a, those are two schools of thought.
Right. Exactly. And we have to make sure that we're recognizing both sides of that particular conversation. Mm-hmm. So let me ask both of you as we're wrapping up here, what would you say as a takeaway for listeners here? Obviously, one of the things we focus on most with this particular series and sustainable investing overall is, you know, for people listening in, it's about investing with your own personal values in mind. And this is something that may be very important to folks. What would you walk away with as a listener if you were listening to this conversation today, Andrew?
I would say that it's definitely something that needs to be addressed. It's something that you can help to address, whether it be through your investments or enacting democracy, working with your local politicians, or reflecting your views through how you vote. I think that this is definitely something that needs to be addressed in the short term and long term. First, in the short term, to address the issues that are hurting people today, and then in the long term, to really stop this from being an issue moving forward, stopping the systemic nature of
it all. Right. And you started off our conversation by talking about how most people focus on the E, the environmental, when it comes to sustainable investing. And I think this is something that might be overlooked by more folks. And I'm glad we're talking about it today. So, Eugenia, as we wrap, what would you say? What would you want folks to walk away with as they're thinking about this conversation?
I would say that, you know, often when we talk about investment and we think about, you know, that companies exist to generate profits, and this is absolutely true. However, I think we need to remember that businesses form part of the social structures of their societies, and that the pursuit of profit should not be their only goal. So companies and investors could be better off trying to ensure that business models are more sustainable by managing long-term risks to the businesses, by focusing on productivity and innovation, by finding ways to contribute to the societies that the businesses depend on their prosperity. And on the investor part, I think we need to accept and to encourage this.
Terrific. Eugenia, thank you so much. What a great conversation with both of you today. Again, we've been speaking with Eugenia Jackson, head of ESG research at Allianz Global Investors, and my colleague here from UBS, Andrew Little, a strategist on the Chief Investment Office team. Thank you both again. Really great to focus on this topic as part of our Sustainable Investing Exchange series. Thanks for doing this with us today.
Thank you.
Of course, anytime.
Great. And for more information on sustainable investing, we encourage you to reach out to your UBS financial advisor. From the studios in New York City, I'm Anthony Pastore. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day, everyone.